from World Radio and the team that brings you the world and everything in it. This is Effective Compassion.
House will be in order.
In 1994, the Republicans won control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years.
Conventional wisdom holds the party of a sitting president loses seats in the midterm elections, but this was a political earthquake.
Bill, these are significant moves up for the Republicans.
5-seat gain by the Republicans.
Republicans are now the majority party both in the Congress and in the governor's mansions across the nation.
The mastermind of this so-called Republican revolution was the brash, white-haired Newt Gingrich of Georgia.
Mr. Doorkeeper.
Mr. Clerk, the Speaker-elect Newt Gingrich, representative from Georgia and the Escort Committee.
The last time Republicans controlled the House was at the end of the Korean War. So this was a massive political event for Washington. All eyes were on Gingrich. On January 4th, 1995, he gave his inaugural speech as Speaker of the House.
We must replace the welfare state with an opportunity society. The balanced budget is the right thing to do. But it doesn't, in my mind, have the moral urgency of coming to grips with what's happening to the poorest Americans.
As Gingrich spoke about the plight of the poor and the urgency of welfare reform, he added this unexpected recommendation.
I commend to all of you Marvin Olasky's The Tragedy of American Compassion. Olasky goes back for 300 years and looks at what has worked in America, how we have helped people rise beyond poverty, how we have reached out to save people. And he may not have the answers, but he has the right sense of where we have to go as Americans.
This podcast is about effective compassion. We draw from the Bible, from interviews in the field, and from history, specifically the history of Christian poverty fighting. This series is about the hard task of restoring hope. This episode is about what happens when 19th century poverty fighting tactics get catapulted onto the national stage.
Effective Compassion is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from World Help, a Christian humanitarian organization working to deliver food and Bibles to starving, persecuted Christians in North Korea, the most dangerous nation for Christians. A gift of $20 sends a Bible and a week's worth of food to a North Korean brother or sister. More at worldhelp.net/podcast.
Back in Austin, the recommendation came as a surprise to Marvin Olasky. He later described that moment to C-SPAN's Brian Lamb.
I was just walking through the kitchen, and there it was. Very, very astonishing, and my life as a result has taken some sharp turns over the past few weeks.
Olasky took a leave of absence from his teaching job at the University of Texas. Washington, D.C.-based reporters like Deborah Roberts started calling to find out more about this obscure professor.
And just who is Marvin Olasky? For starters, he's not a politician. He's a writer. But during the last few years, he's managed to grab the attention of Republican leaders with his book documenting the history of programs for the poor.
When Brian Lamb interviewed Olasky, he described his difficulty finding the book.
When I first heard about this book, I tried to find it. And I went to the traditional bookstores, right, and there were no copies available. But they helped me find it in a Christian bookstore out in the suburbs here of Washington. Right.
And he wasn't the only one having trouble finding the book. After Newt Gingrich mentioned it, the publisher, Regnery Gateway, scrambled to reprint it.
So if someone sees you tonight and they're listening to this and they go to their bookstore, it won't be there?
It won't be in the bookstore right now, but there's a new paperback edition that will be out in about a week.
Published in 1992, the book had never been a blockbuster.
There were some reviews that that were favorable and said that we should pay attention to this. There were other reviews that said, well, this is a nice notion, but has no real practical application. And there was some conversation about it and talk about it, and sold a few copies, and then I think pretty much died.
But before it died, a few influential people read it. Bill Bennett for one, and the Wall Street Journal's John Fund for another. Philanthropist Heather Higgins got a copy, and from them it eventually made its way to Newt Gingrich. And a week or two later, the new speaker was advertising it from the U.S. House. The beliefs that had motivated Christian poverty fighters in the 19th century were once again in the spotlight. And the ideas weren't just motivating individuals and small nonprofits. They were fueling a national political debate over welfare reform.
The current welfare system needs repair. It doesn't enable people to become self-sufficient. It sends the wrong messages to welfare recipients that work doesn't pay and that welfare can become a trap.
No more tinkering around the edges with a system that has cost American taxpayers $5.4 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars, in federal and state spending over the past 35 years.
Senators and congressmen, many of them Christians, started battling for congressional backing. They wanted policy change. They wanted faith-based community renewal.
There's not a social problem you can identify that somewhere someone isn't successfully addressing that problem.
Prominent figures included Dan Coats, Rick Santorum, Steve Largent, J.C. Watts, Jim Talent, and John Ashcroft.
I want to also say how pleased I am to see that the modified amendment includes a provision which recognizes that government programs alone will never solve all of our welfare needs. We've got to allow states to involve a number of non-governmental charitable organizations, including faith-based organizations in serving the poor.
They pushed for a charitable choice provision. It was hard for faith-based groups to participate in government programs meant to help the poor. So the goal was to remove those barriers. Politicians also used their platforms to highlight groups successfully fighting poverty and homelessness. Let's look at three examples. The first group was Bob Woodson Center for Neighborhood Enterprise.
Solutions to poverty exist. They can be found in the grassroots, and these come from the bottom up.
Woodson worked with former street gang members and people who lived in public housing. He argued that small neighborhood groups, not the government, should revitalize urban communities.
It is clear that the Harvards of this country can never solve the problems of the Harlems of this country. They have to be solved by the people living there.
A second group was Step 13, a homeless shelter in Denver. It was founded by a former street drunk named Bob Cote. Step 13 had a record of taking long-term alcoholics and transforming them into productive citizens. Cote was a tough guy with a soft heart for down-and-outers, and he hated the poverty industry.
If you have an alcohol or drug addiction, then you qualify for supplemental Social Security income, $517 a month. SSI, as far as I'm concerned, stands for suicide on the installment plan. And they ought to put a warning label on there, just like they do on cigarettes. Warning, this can be addictive, it can kill you, you can become dependent, and it's wrong, wrong, wrong for taxpayers to be subsidizing addiction.
A third group was in San Antonio. That's where ex-heroin addict Freddie Garcia was changing lives through his Christian outreach called Victory Fellowship. Victory Fellowship successfully helped drug addicts and alcoholics become sober. And it taught them about Jesus, which gave their lives purpose.
I can tell them that my program is not a rehabilitation center. Victory Fellowship is a church that rehabilitates people through the gospel of Jesus Christ, through the Word of God. That's how our people are rehabilitated.
But then things got complicated. It happened about 6 months after Newt Gingrich's speech. Officials from the Texas Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse, or TCADA, decided to crack down on unlicensed addiction programs. That hit groups like Garcia's Victory Fellowship and others, including a group called Teen Challenge. These organizations didn't hire counselors with academic degrees. They believed in the power of Christ to change lives. Freddie Garcia had met Christ through a Teen Challenge program. He said, if an addict meets Christ, he's transformed. He's a whole new person. But that wasn't good enough for TCADA. The agency viewed addiction as a disease, and it had a thick manual of requirements it wanted counselors to meet. In 1995, TCADA threatened to shut down Teen Challenge. They called Freddie Garcia and said he had 30 days to get licensed.
I said, let me remind you, hey, I'm producing more cured drug addicts than you are. And they didn't care about that. I wasn't qualified because I didn't have the degrees.
Freddie Garcia and Bob Woodson organized a rally at the Alamo in San Antonio, Texas. About 300 former addicts showed up outside the iconic fort, the symbol of Texas independence. They held signs proclaiming their freedom from addiction through Jesus.
all of my leadership, all my staff are ex-drug addicts, ex-gang members, ex-criminals, and ex-prostitutes. And they don't have degrees. We don't have a degree. I don't have a degree. But I've got an education out there in the streets that you won't find. I don't have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, or a doctor's degree. But I've got an education out there in the streets that you won't find in Yale University. Nothing you're going to teach me about the streets.
Marvin Olasky wrote about the protest in World Magazine and the Wall Street Journal. The stories alerted both Christians and conservative policymakers to the power of government to snuff out effective compassion. Politicians paid attention, including first-year Texas Governor George W. Bush. Angry mail poured into his office. Most of it repeated the Teen Challenge demand: get the government off our back.
The state has so many regulations, so many red tape, so many hindrances that eliminates people like myself that don't have degrees, but we're qualified to reach the teenagers, we're qualified to reach the gang members. All we ask is the government to untie our hands, set us free, set people like myself free so we can reach these people in the streets.
Governor George W. Bush became a public advocate for Teen Challenge. By the end of the year, TCADA had enough. The agency backed off. Teen Challenge got what it wanted. And Bush was championing the cause of other faith-based charities, a cause he would later pursue as president. But the 1995 showdown at the Alamo highlighted for many people the problem of modern governmental poverty fighting. It tried to ban God from the premises, often hiding behind the separation of church and state.
I don't think we want to find ourselves in a country where the majority religion is able to make decisions that require the obedience of every other person, religious or otherwise.
But while many politicians and media pundits fought against faith-based initiatives, polls showed popular support was strong and growing.
According to an NBC News poll, 68% of Americans favor giving federal funds to private organizations, including religious ones, to help with social problems.
In 1996, Newt Gingrich and the 104th Congress sent two welfare reform bills to the president. Clinton vetoed them both. But when a third bill landed on his desk, the political risk was just too great to ignore it. So President Clinton reluctantly signed the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act on August 22, 1996.
What we are trying to do today is to overcome the flaws of the welfare system for the people who are trapped on it. We all know that the typical family on welfare today is very different from the one that welfare was designed to deal with 60 years ago. From now on, our nation's answer to this great social challenge will no longer be a never-ending cycle of welfare. It will be the dignity, the power, and the ethic of work. Today, we are taking an historic chance to make welfare what it was meant to be, a second chance, not a way of life.
For the first time in a long time, government poverty fighting appeared to be ready to embrace challenge. But it was still a long way from being personal or spiritual. However, the welfare reform legislation did contain the charitable choice provision. It was there to ensure religious groups wouldn't have to give up their faith distinctives in order to apply for government grants. The Clinton administration didn't publicize it, and not much happened nationally. Before long, Washington, D.C. was consumed with gossip about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Then came impeachment. Newt Gingrich and the Congress shifted their attention to Social Security reform, and charitable choice was all but forgotten. As George W. Bush prepared for his 2000 presidential run, he brought renewed attention to the work of faith-based charities. He called himself a compassionate conservative. That was the title of a second Olasky book. It envisioned a decentralized welfare system that empowered faith-based charities to play a more central role. Bush even wrote the foreword to the book. He called Olasky compassionate conservatism's leading thinker. And he said Olasky's view is an approach I share.
There must be a greater purpose to prosperity, and that is to make sure the American dream touches every willing heart. And that's why I will talk about unleashing faith-based institutions and charities that warm the cold of life so that people understand the American dream is meant for them and so that we can usher in the responsibility era as we head into the 21st century.
So was it possible the country would see a reversal in its 70-year drive to centralize power in Washington? Was it possible that faith-based charities would once again play a central role? Well, we'll talk about that in a future episode. But first, we'll be heading back to Austin, Texas, where Redeemer Prez and the New Start program are trying a new approach to help broken families.
Several years, we helped him find a job and a place to live. I tried to be a friend, went to his mom's funeral. But Fred had spent so much time in prison that he never really felt comfortable in what he called the free world. It was almost as if he wanted to be back in jail. So after a couple of months, he would do something and he'd go back to where he felt most at home.
That's next time on Effective Compassion. Effective Compassion is produced by World Radio. This episode was written by Susan Alasky and Anna Johansson. Our technical engineer is Rich Rosel, and I'm your host, Paul Butler.
Effective Compassion is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from World Help, a Christian humanitarian organization serving the physical and spiritual needs of people in some of the world's most hard-to-reach places. Help for today, hope for tomorrow. Right now, World Help has a window of opportunity to deliver food and Bibles to starving, persecuted Christians in North Korea, the most dangerous nation for Christians. A gift of $20 sends a Bible and a week's worth of food to Christians living in this hostile country. More at worldhelp.net/podcast.
For the next few weeks, you'll be hearing Effective Compassion on The World and Everything in It every Saturday. Episode 6 releases next week, February 8th. We're also releasing Effective Compassion as a standalone series, and we're publishing new episodes on Tuesdays. So if you want to listen sooner and help others find this new series, you can subscribe by searching for Effective Compassion on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.